Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Today we continue our two-part program on Henry Ford's amazing book, The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. This book was the product of thousands of man-hours of labor, performed by the best researchers and journalists that the great industrialist was able to recruit. Henry Ford picked these men not for any preconceived opinions they may have had. His chief researcher, William Cameron, originally balked at criticizing Jewish activities, but for their honesty and skill. Ford believed that once enough of these facts were before them, that these men, recruited from many of the top newspapers of the day, would enthusiastically get behind the project. And Ford was right. Let's ignore the hysterical claims that this is a work of hate and look inside the book for ourselves. Here are a few quotes. Quote, "The Jew is the world's enigma. Poor in his masses, yet he controls the world's finances. Scattered abroad without country or government, he yet presents a unity of race continuity which no other people has achieved. Living under legal disabilities in almost every land, he has become the power behind many a throne." The single description, which will include a larger percentage of Jews than members of any other race, is this: he is in business. It may only be gathering rags and selling them, but he is in business. From the sale of old clothes to the control of international trade and finance, the Jew is supremely gifted for business. More than any other race, he exhibits a decided aversion to industrial employment, which he balances by an equally decided adaptability to trade. In America alone, most of the big business, the trusts and the banks, the natural resources and the chief agricultural products, especially tobacco, cotton, and sugar, are in the control of Jewish financiers or their agents. Jewish journalists are a large and powerful group here. "Large numbers of department stores are held by Jewish firms," says the Jewish Encyclopedia, "and many, if not most of them, are run under Gentile names." Jews are the largest and most numerous landlords of residence property in the country. They are supreme in the theatrical world. They absolutely control the circulation of publications throughout the country. Fewer than any race whose presence among us is noticeable, they receive daily an amount of favorable publicity which would be impossible did they not have the facilities for creating and distributing it themselves. The question is, if the Jew is in control, how did it happen? This is a free country. The Jew comprises only about 3% of the population. To every Jew, there are 97 Gentiles. To the 3 million Jews in the United States, there are 97 million Gentiles. If the Jew is in control, is it because of his superior ability? Or is it because of the inferiority and don't care attitude of the Gentiles? It would be very simple to answer that the Jews came to America, took their chances like other people, and proved more successful in the competitive struggle. But that would not include all the facts. The fact of Jewish solidarity renders it difficult to measure Gentile and Jewish achievements by the same standard. When a great block of wealth in America was made possible by the lavish use of another block of wealth from across the seas, that is to say, when certain Jewish immigrants came to the United States with the financial backing of European Jewry behind them, it would be unfair to explain the rise of that class of immigration by the same rules which account for the rise of, say, the Germans or the Poles, who came here with no resource but their ambition and strength. To be sure, many individual Jews came in that way too, with no dependents but themselves. But it would not be true to say that the massive control of affairs which is exercised by Jewish wealth was won by individual initiative. It was rather the extension of financial control across the sea. That, indeed, is where any explanation of Jewish control must begin. Here is a race whose entire period of national history saw them peasants on the land, whose ancient genius was spiritual rather than material, bucolic rather than commercial. Yet today, when they have no country, no government, and are persecuted in one way or another everywhere they go, they are declared to be the principal, though unofficial, rulers of the earth. How does so strange a change arise? And why do so many circumstances seem to justify it? That which we call capital here in America is usually money used in production, and we mistakenly refer to the manufacturer, the manager of work, the provider of tools and jobs, we refer to him as the capitalist. Oh no, he is not the capitalist in the real sense. Why, he himself must go to capitalists for the money with which to finance his plans. There is a power yet above him, a power which treats him far more callously and holds him in a more ruthless hand than he would ever dare display to labor. That indeed is one of the tragedies of these times, that labor and capital are fighting each other, when the conditions against which each one of them protests and from which each one of them suffers is not within their power to remedy at all, unless they find a way to wrest world control from that group of international financiers who create and control both these conditions. There is a super capitalism. There is a super government, which is allied to no government, which is free from them all, and yet which has its hand in them all. There is a race, a part of humanity, which has never yet been received as a welcome part, and which has succeeded in raising itself to a power that the proudest Gentile race has never claimed, not even Rome in the days of her proudest power. It is becoming more and more the conviction of men all over the world that the labor question, the wage question, the land question cannot be settled until, first of all, this matter of an international, super-capitalistic government is settled. Close quote. Hardly the work of a mindless hater, wouldn't you say? And wouldn't you say that these opening words, written in 1920, accurately describe the plight in which we find ourselves today? Henry Ford's The International Jew, though little known today because of decades of Jewish suppression, was a major international bestseller, read by literally millions of thoughtful men and women the world over. By bringing it back to light, and by using our newly found freedom to read and publish on the internet, without needing the help of gatekeepers in Washington or New York, we can renew its influence for generations to come. Now, neither the International Jew nor Henry Ford were perfect. Ford and Cameron reflected the prejudices of their times when they took irrelevant stabs at Darwin and Nietzsche, probably due to their self-identification as Christians. They were sometimes too eager to accept quotes and documents from dubious sources when much stronger documentation on the same points was readily available. And when tremendous financial pressure was brought to bear, and when a mysterious automobile accident sent Ford to the hospital, coming close to killing him, one of his subordinates forged his signature on a phony apology written for the purpose by prominent Jewish attorney Louis Marshall. His post-apology actions indicate that Ford had not altered his opinions, though. Gerald L.K. Smith visited Ford in 1940, many years after the supposed apology, and Ford had not altered his opinions of Jewish activities and said he was considering reissuing the book. Despite its flaws, The International Jew is a magnificent work, a priceless distillation of many thousands of man-hours of expensive research and compilation, a magnifying glass applied to the hidden sources of immorality, vice, degeneracy, and subversion. The International Jew was once available in libraries and bookstores across America. As I've already pointed out, it was one of the biggest bestsellers of all time. Henry Ford felt that his book was so important that at one point a copy was presented to all purchasers of new Ford automobiles. When I first wrote about Ford's book in 1994, I said, quote, "Yet today this book is almost impossible to find. You will not be able to buy it in your local bookstore nor check it out at your local library. If it were not for a few courageous Americans keeping it in print and available to you, you would not be able to find it at all. The truth is that here in so-called democratic, pluralist America, this book has been nakedly suppressed." Close quote. When I wrote that, only the National Alliance, Liberty Bell Publications, and a handful of other little-known mail-order dealers were selling Ford's book. They carried us through a very dark time of Jewish censorship. Since then, though, we have seen the rise of the Internet, and one of the results of the net has been a great increase in alternative media and an increase in freedom of speech and freedom to publish without having to pass muster at a New York publisher or book distributor. You still won't find The International Jew on the shelves of the big chain bookstores or in any display of banned books at your local library, where it really deserves to be. But it is a sign of the near total failure of Jewish groups to control the burgeoning Internet. Not that they haven't tried and are still trying. When one can simply enter the words International Jew into the search engine at Amazon.com and come up with a half dozen sources for this once rare volume, or put the same search into Google and get over 100,000. Recently, a pro-white radio network, the White Network, carried the International Jew Study Hour, a series of hour-long programs devoted to discussion of this book. Despite all their lobbying of legislatures to protect our children from hate, read, prevent our children from reading criticism of multiracialism or Jewish power, despite all the hate filters they developed and all the anti-hate laws they've pushed through, the International Jew and the truth about race, racial science, and Jewish power generally is more easily available now than it has ever been. That's near total failure on their part. Why are Jewish groups so hostile to this book? Is it because this book is a hate-filled anti-Jewish polemic? No, not at all. This book's tone is not at all anti-Jewish, and again, it appeals to the reason and moral sense of its Jewish readers to put a stop to the abuses of their leaders. It is scrupulously fair, even-handed, and factual. It is because of its extensive documentation and the unassailable facts which it presents. For the International Jew is a threat. It's a threat to those men of money and power who would put a sack over our heads and force us unknowingly and unwillingly into the world plantation they have been preparing for us for decades. This book is a threat to those who would take away our weapons of self-defense, who would rob us of our racial consciousness, destroy our genetic and cultural heritage, take away our self-determination and freedom, and ruin our children's future. Consider this. Henry Ford did not have to do what he did. He was the living incarnation of success. He was by far the richest industrialist of his day. He was loved and admired by millions. Among the common people, he was ranked with the greatest men of all time. Political power could have been his had he wanted it. He had nothing personal to gain and all of that to lose by directly attacking the world's wealthiest ethnic group. But he did go forward with his investigation and explication of the Jewish question, at the cost of a large portion of his wealth, at the cost of much of the time and energy of the last half of his life, and at the cost of the alienation of friends, associates, and even family members. And he well knew that he was potentially putting his life in peril by opposing these powerful moneyed interests. Henry Ford did this because he felt a higher duty, a duty that transcended all of those considerations. Henry Ford acted in obedience to a duty which we of our generation must rediscover if our children are to have a future. However discouraging the odds may seem at the moment, and no matter how easy it may be to slip back into our easy chair or into our accustomed work, we must discharge this duty. Wherever we find it, and whatever disguise it wears, we must oppose the genocide of our people. Henry Ford, alas, was not a thoroughgoing racial thinker. He identified as a Christian as much as he did a white American. He did not see the Jewish question in biological terms, as Jewish leaders unquestionably do, and as we must if we are to prevent our racial obliteration by the replacement migration and racial mixture currently being promoted by the Jewish power structure. Again and again, Ford and his researchers deplore the decline of Christian institutions or Christian-oriented law as if Christianity were synonymous with us as a people. Ford did not see Christianity itself as a Jewish-created and Jewish-oriented belief system. Worst of all, perhaps, is the fact that the book offers only one solution to the Jewish question, and that solution is simply a plea for Jews to reject their current leadership, to stop their parasitic and exploitative activities, to stop doing what's best for Jews and start doing what's best for everybody, and to stop their manifold efforts to undermine their host societies with degeneracy, vice, and suicidal propaganda. Ford and Cameron address their plea to decent Jews. They saw no need, apparently, to call for any action on the part of the rest of us. The most charitable thing I can say about their plea is that it failed. There have been significant defectors from the Jewish power structure. David Cole, Alfred Lilienthal, and Benjamin H. Friedman come immediately to mind, and the latter was a millionaire who spent his fortune in exposing the actions of his co-racialists. But it was not enough. Today, even more than in 1920, the Jewish power structure is focused on undermining our racial identity and preventing us from achieving racial self-determination. In short, it is focused on their unstated but obvious goal of white genocide. There are Jews who oppose this, but their numbers are small and their power is negligible even in their own community. In this 11th hour for our people, we need to depend on ourselves alone. Our clarion call must be primarily to our own people, to awaken them to their great peril and even greater potential destiny, and to organize ourselves to achieve that destiny. We must build our own power structure, responsible to ourselves alone. The international Jew can be a tool for awakening white men and women and helping them understand what went wrong and how they ended up a hounded, hated, soon-to-be minority in the nations our forefathers created. Put this book in the hands of your friends, your neighbors, your children, and your co-workers. But do not fail to also tell them what Henry Ford did not. It's up to us, and us alone, to build a new society on the ashes of the old, a new nation where clever aliens can never get their hands around our necks again, where they can never even gain a foothold, because they will be recognized for what they are. For increasing that recognition, for spreading that awareness, we will always give our thanks to Henry Ford. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the reconstituted National Alliance membership organization, founded by William Luther Pierce in 1970. This program is published every week at whitebiocentrism.com and nationalvanguard.org. Please write to us at National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. We welcome your support, your inquiries, and your help in spreading our message of hope to our people. Once again, that address is Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you of the words of Richard Berkeley Cotton. Freedom is not free. Free men are not equal, and equal men are not free.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth.
sky.